Okay, so welcome everyone to the March 25th, 2020, 9/11 and other deep state crimes monthly teleconference. We've agreed to postpone all the roll call, et cetera, till at the end of our speakers. So we're going to start right now with Cynthia McKinney. We're very fortunate to have with us tonight, and Frank Tolupko is going to introduce her. So Frank, go ahead.
Cynthia McKinney was the 2008 Green Party candidate for president and a former U.S. congressman. She is the author of Ain't Nothing Like Freedom and editor of The Illegal War on Libya and How the U.S. Creates Shithole Countries. She holds a B.A. from the University of Southern California, a Master of Arts in Law and Diplomacy from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and a Ph.D. from Antioch University, where she did extensive study on the leadership challenges faced by President Hugo Chavez as he asserted the Bolivarian Republic, Venezuela's right to sovereignty. Some may not remember her from December 2008 when she sailed on the SS Dignity, attempting to bring humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. The boat was interdicted by the IDF and forced to not land and return to its home port. Others may remember her from the congressional hearing in March of 2005, where she essentially forced the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Myers to admit there were war games going being conducted on 9/11. More recently, she is the editor of a book that's soon to be published, or I don't know how soon, I think it's sometime later in the year, When China Sneezes, From the Wuhan Lockdown to the Global Political Economic Implications, and she's the editor of the book, which, among other things, raises the other disturbing questions such as, has the morbidity projection been overblown by Western sources? Has the event been used to fan ethnic aversion and isolate China? What about blowback and unintended consequences, among other things? I think best to wind up here by quoting Paul Craig Roberts that said, America and the Constitution will be safe today. Cynthia McKinney or a similar person is President of the United States.
Cool. All right, so thank you, Frank. I'm going to put everyone in lecture mode, Cynthia, so just hang on a moment because I'll have to unmute you. Oh, Cynthia, can you speak now, or are you muted?
I'm unmuted now. So anyway, thank you, Frank, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for inviting me to come and just sort of talk about what I'm working on right now. And I guess maybe I should start with let's sort of go back in time to 2019, and China was all in the news, and there was an allegation that was put against China that it was mistreating its Muslim population. And I wanted to know how much of it was true and how much of it wasn't true, because what I had discovered through the research of my students was that the Organization of Islamic Countries, the OIC, had actually awarded China for its treatment of its Muslims. So it was like, you know, so you've got the OIC, which is comprised of the Muslim countries, applauding China, and you've got the United States condemning China. And I wanted to know just what the heck was going on. So basically what I did was the same thing that I did for the Libya book, and that is that I just gathered people around who were willing to go to Libya. Well, this time was slightly different because we had to self-finance, and I had the objective of getting people from across the political spectrum. So I wanted the alt-left, the left, the center, the right, the alt-right, all of them to be represented, as well as being able to self-finance on this trip. So that was quite a challenge. It took us about basically the entire year to organize it. But right after Christmas, the day after Christmas, we left and we went to China. And we started in Beijing. From there, we went to Xi'an. From there, we went to Dunhuang. And there you start to see the kafiyas, and you begin, well, actually, in Xi'an, we stayed in a Muslim hotel. And then you begin to see the different flavors of China. And we ended up in Urumqi, which is where the Xinjiang province is, which is the autonomous Uyghur province. Those are the Turkish people who are non-Han. The Han people are the majority in China, and so the Uyghurs are the a minority group, but they are recognized in China's constitution. And in fact, the constitution calls out the Han people for their chauvinism. And in the constitution, they write about how they want to have a China that is a multi-ethnic, multiracial China, and China, the state of China, is for all the Chinese people. So with that, then I was able to gather 20 people from the U.S. and the U.K., and we went there, and we stayed until the last of us left January 10th. And then after we left, the shoe dropped, and that's when the lockdown began in earnest on January 20th. So with that kind of expansive experience, just off the heels of such an experience, I decided that I would approach Clarity Press and suggest that we do a book on on the coronavirus. And so then I was challenged, okay, well, put together a draft table of contents, which is the normal procedure. And so I did that. And again, what I wanted to do was to include people from across the spectrum in this book. And because of the unique contents that what we're looking at, I wanted to make sure that we had people who lived in China but who were not Chinese, so we could get that kind of flavor included in the book as well. So we have been successful in recruiting the contributors to the book now. And so actually within 1 week, I'm supposed to receive the manuscripts from the contributors, but I haven't even written my own chapter. And I'm going to have to get into that very quickly. One of the things in terms of quality control that we wanted to make sure of, because, of course, you know, there's a lot about, in fact, I just posted on my Twitter page just a few minutes ago that Nature magazine has put out a article in the study's name about a study, and the study's name is that coronavirus has natural origins. Well, you know, the fact that they even felt that they needed to do that, I believe, shows the weakness of their ability to keep a secret about the origins of the coronavirus and this outbreak. And basically, from the studies that I've read, we still don't know patient zero and we don't know ground zero, although I believe that there are some civilians, some citizen journalists who are getting close to the answer on that. And, of course, that will be very, very important. So basically, in order to dissuade the, although it's impossible to, you know, if you come out with the truth or provide enough evidence so that people can draw their own conclusion and it's at variance with the official narrative, then you're going to get called names. But basically what we decided, and when I say we, I mean the publisher and I, we decided that we would restrict the contributors to PhDs, MDs, or people who have such professional experience, who are great at investigations. And so basically that's what we have. So the name of the book is When China Sneezes, From the Wuhan Lockdown to the Global Political Economic Implications. And so now I intend to write the introduction, and I will also write the conclusion. I also will write a chapter on biowarfare as genocide using the U.S. experience, as well as we've got some others like Israel and South Africa that also were trying to fashion biological bombs with which they could destroy certain target populations. So I'm going to write about that. But we also begin the book just with a basic understanding of what is the coronavirus. And so that's just basic science, and we've got a scientist who is writing that. Actually, I believe he's a toxicologist. I have not yet asked them to provide their short bios, so I have to go off my memory. And basically what I do is I find people who write in the academic journals. Generally, they're not willing to write, but I still ask them anyway. And then you find the renegades. Those are the people who have written, maybe they spent a lifetime trying to write in the academic journals, but you know, when you say peer-reviewed, basically what that means is a small group of people are going to decide whether or not your knowledge is worthy of publication. And that is fraught with danger if you're trying to tell a truth or trying to deviate from a narrative, and we don't have very many outlets that will allow the kind of freedom of thought that's supposed to exist in the academic settings. Okay, so we start out just talking about coronaviruses, and I've got the scientist who's doing that, and then I have someone for chapter two who's actually lived most of his life in China. And he's writing about the research that was done. So when I decided that I wanted to understand what kind of research was being done on coronaviruses, basically I went to the Federation of American Scientists website, and they used to have a map of the level four U.S. financed level four bio labs that are located and their locations around the world, because U.S. financed bio labs exist not only in the United States but also in other parts of the world. And that had been taken down by Google. So that information was not easily accessible, but I found some other people who had done that kind of research and made it public. So I sent that over to the author of Chapter 2 so that he would have a place to start if he didn't already. There was lots of things that he already knows just because of living in China for such a long time. Then the third chapter is looking at other pandemics that have existed, SARS, MERS, Ebola, and basically we've got the flu we're looking at as well, and sort of kind of defining what is a pandemic. Then the book initially was just going to feature people who were living in China during the lockdown, and I wanted their sort of like diaries about what it was like, what did they do, what were they thinking, how were they feeling. I wanted that kind of personal story to tell. But then, of course, the publisher came back and said, well, we can do a whole lot more with this because after she got into the subject matter, she said, oh, my gosh, there's so much here. And so that's how the book began to expand. And so we've got these personalized stories about the lockdown and those experiences. And what I did was I selected people who were in China, still are in China, but are not Chinese. And they are telling their stories. And, of course, because they're there and their lives are, you know, uncertain at this point. So this part of the book is anonymous, and these are anonymous contributions. Not even the publisher knows who these people are. But I've got Chinese, and I've got Americans, U.S. citizens. I've got Africans, and it's a nice little peppering of people from around the globe who found themselves, for whatever reason, inside China during this lockdown period. And then there was a story of that I found pretty interesting. I was able to track this young person down who was outside of China at the time and couldn't get back in. So that I've got that story in that part of the book, which is in the chapter, it's like in the section called Living Through the Lockdown. We also take a look at in this part two, which is the lockdown, we also take a look at Patient Zero and Ground Zero. And up until literally a few minutes ago, I had no idea in terms of, with specificity, who Patient Zero and where Ground Zero could possibly be. But because of some really, really dedicated and committed citizen investigative journalists, I think we're a lot closer to that. And I'll tell you about that later in the question and answer period. And then, of course, China's remarkable response. So they literally built 2,000-bed hospitals in like 10 days. It was just amazing to see it. And one of the photographs of those tractors in the area is what is on the front cover of the book. So we focus on China's response, and we've got some a person who lives in China right now who wrote one chapter, and we have a person who lives in the United States who was looking at that, and she wrote another chapter. Then we move to part three, where we discuss the economic policy. So the economic impact. And so basically, what does all this mean for the Chinese economy? What does this mean for the U.S. economy? What does it mean for the global economy? And in the recruitment of the contributors, here is where I shocked myself, because I just, you know, sort of went to the top and I said, I want this person. And they responded and they said yes. So we've got some great internationally renowned economists who have agreed to provide chapters in the economic section. And then in the latter part of the book, we go to where we discuss biowarfare. Because, of course, you know, on page 60 of the Project for a New American Century, Rebuilding America's Defenses, what they talk about is the politically useful tool of weapons that can target certain populations. So they go there. The PNAC goes there. And so then we decided that we would go there in this book. So I've got a chapter on DARPA and the bioweapons development program that operates from DARPA. And then we talk about biowarfare as genocide. That would be my chapter. We've got biowarfare as economic warfare, and I've got a professor from Italy who has already, he's been really fast, and he's already written his chapter and sent it in to me, so I'll have to review that. And I also asked him to discuss in his chapter a little bit about what it was like in the lock, you know, to experience the Italian lockdown. So that should be a very interesting chapter. And then I've got the propaganda, biowarfare as propaganda. And we've got a great young writer who's experienced and very good researcher who will make that contribution. And then just want to talk about the dysfunctionality of biowarfare. And I think now, of course, you could say that one entity might have had the intention to spread this virus around the world, but then they have to contend with it too. And so that this needs to be attacked on not only the moral grounds, but on even the logical grounds. And so we've got sort of the dysfunctionality and the inconceivability of states actually engaging in biowarfare as a form of hybrid warfare. Then with all of that, I added another chapter just 2 days ago, and I found a reporter for RT who has agreed to write that chapter with one of her friends. And basically, it's like, what's the end game? So we collect all of this information, but then where do we take it? And I think even I just got a friend who sent me the bill that is, I guess, to be voted on. I have to get the clarification from him if this is the actual bill that they are voting on or if this is one of the earlier versions. But the key to, one of the keys to where this all is taking us will be in that bill. For example, I've read that there was something that in Nancy Pelosi's bill about digital wallets and digital currency, but not like, you know, the digital currencies that we know about, Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin, those, not that. And so then there's another story of the DOJ asking for the power to detain people indefinitely. And then there's probably other affronts. There's something that I think William Barr just did that I'm not too sure about, but that is also an affront to the Constitution. And so there will be little nuggets of what kind of world this will take us into. One of the things that a friend of mine that I sent to the people who are writing that was the vaccinations and the digital ID. And I don't know if you guys saw that, but that's already being implemented in the country where I teach, and that's in Bangladesh. So with everyone, you know, every other word that comes out of anybody's mouth of authority is about vaccination, vaccination, vaccination. Well, there is definitely an agenda there as well. And so then the final chapter will be written by me, where I'll just sort of wrap this all up and try and explain that perhaps, I don't know yet how I'm going to take it, but I'll probably take it in the direction of Dr. Peter Dale Scott and his deep state analysis, which is something I did for Charlie Hebdo, and it was pretty well received, so I might do that again. And in that, I would apply Peter Dale Scott's model about how we can determine whether or not something is a deep event representing deep politics within the deep state, and apply it to what we know so far about the coronavirus. And I think it will be a very, very good book. And again, I've got people from all of the political spectrum as participants here, and that we can actually produce something from our disparate points of view, but all that point to the same with the same vision, I think is very important for what that means in terms of what we need to do and what we might need to be stopping as a result when we get to the point where we can actually talk to each other again and congregate closely. So that basically is the book, the reason for the book, how the book came to be about. And I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you, Cynthia. I'm going to put us into, and if you'd like to ask Cynthia a question, please do *6, and you'll get in the queue. And Cynthia, while they're doing that, I just want to ask you, when do you anticipate the book being released? Oops, maybe I have to unmute you. Let's see. Yep, I do.
Oh, okay. We have a pretty firm publication date of October 1, and so I'll have to get all of the manuscripts in, edit them, and do all of that work and have it all back to the publisher so that we can sort of hit the ground with hard copies by October 1.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, and all right, so we have a long queue here, so I ask people to please keep it brief, a brief comment, a quick question. Thank you. We're going to start off with Barbara Honegger. Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, Cynthia. Barbara Honegger. Great to hear your voice.
Yes. I don't know if you can hear mine yet, if I'm muted or not.
No, it's there was something about muting all of us that really cleared up the audio signal, so that's great. So,
okay.
Yeah, so first off, I want to applaud you for doing the book, obviously. It's a wonderful project. I'm glad you're doing it. I'm just wanting to point out, I'm wondering why you haven't mentioned the obvious link, or maybe you can consider it for a chapter linking 9/11 to the coronavirus, to the fact that, to the chapter on the evidence that it is, in fact, an engineered bioweapon. And to link it to 9/11 through, of course, the biowarfare attack of the anthrax attacks.
Oh, you know what, Barbara? You are still my sister, and I apologize for just kind of losing touch with you. But I had to leave the country, you know, in order to make a living. You know how that goes. So, but you are absolutely right, because anthrax is definitely there. And you know, I guess that would fall to Graham McQueen. I need to reach out to him. I will do so.
Well, it might fall to me as well, because my work is my work on the anthrax links to the day of 9/11 itself, which he doesn't go into, is absolutely central. So. You know, I'll send you my paper that's already been published in Op-Ed News, and you can decide if you'd like to follow that up, or maybe have both of us put in something. But I do think that this is something that needs to be done for the book, because it's critical.
Yes,
people are already talking about the coronavirus for people who are aware of the evidence that it's bioengineered, that it's basically a bioweapon. Whether it leaked out or it was consciously targeted is a secondary matter. But that very fact links it directly to 9/11 through the so-called second wave of the anthrax letter attacks, and which, of course, was the pretext for the Patriot Act and everything that's happened since. So I really
Yes.
think they need to be linked. I just published a piece in American Herald Tribune, Tony Hall. He's on this call. He's the editor-in-chief there. We just published that. Forgive the pun. It's gone viral. Sorry for the pun.
Okay, you know what? Yeah, and in fact, I have had the anthrax attacks in my mind. I've been walking around with this in my mind for like the last 2 weeks. So what you're saying is absolutely appropriate. So why don't you and I, is your email address the same?
It is, and yours is still HQ something, right?
Yes, correct. So why don't we get together afterwards? Because I think I don't have to, you know, shoot, I don't even have to do the conclusion. I could find somebody else who would be willing to write the conclusion and make that draw the parallels, because they're definitely valid.
Well, or you can, another alternative is that you have Graham's book and you have my work, and you can put them together and write it yourself. But my main point is that I really think that chapter is critical, because many people in the alternative press, including myself, are now making it clear that they're calling the coronavirus attacks. They're calling them attacks, and that they are the second 9/11.
Yes. In fact, actually, let me just go right here and on my draft table of contents, and let me just add that in.
Oh, that was quick.
Oh, you know, I'm action oriented, so if I get a good idea, mm-hmm. I'm gonna deal with it. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk, and it doesn't have to be me. It doesn't have to be Graham. I think it should be you, but we'll provide you with the reference and cited information.
Okay, this is fabulous. So now I've got 18 chapters. Oh, my gosh, the publisher is going to kill me. But anyway, it's necessary. I mean, you know, it's what needs to happen. So, yeah, thank you so much for that suggestion.
All right, thank you so much, Cynthia. We'll talk.
Okay.
Next question is from Richard Krushnick. Richard, go ahead.
Had the opportunity to chat with somebody who worked with a top security clearance at Fort Detrick for a couple of years out of his military service. And he had done a little research into the recent events with the Chinese guy who was working with the arrested Harvard professor and was arrested at Logan Airport with 21 vials at the end of the year. It was the end of December or the 1st of January or something. And then there was a couple of other, there was another guy working with that professor who made it back to China successfully. And then there was a couple of other Chinese, I think they were working with a contractor that was working with Fort Detrick. But anyway, this guy looked up the Wuhan site, and he found a listing of employees and affiliates, and he found the names of all four of these Chinese guys that had been over here listed as employees or affiliates of the Wuhan site. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in, and I was wondering if you had seen anything else that might indicate, as just one of the possibilities, that this was a U.S.-developed strain that had been essentially stolen and taken back to Wuhan.
Well, I know that Professor Boyle has made some suggestions that the material was stolen by China.
What I read by him, it didn't include any actual evidence. It was just sort of, you know, he was just sort of putting that out there. But I didn't see him citing any evidence.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, there is at least some circumstantial evidence indicating this is a lively possibility, that's all. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if it's theft or if it's, you know, I don't know exactly what the relationship is, but there is a relationship. For example, you've got, it could have been that the Chinese were trying to figure out what the heck was going on in these level 3 and level 4 biolabs, and they were trying to protect themselves from what might have been going on, because if you know the this is, you know, biology is not, I couldn't even touch the frog, let alone, you know, pitch it. But
if I was a Chinese and I could get my hands on something that was an emerging weaponized thing, I would certainly try to take it back to China and develop a defense against it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Exactly. And that was my thinking, because, of course, you know, with SARS and with MERS, both of them basically attacked a certain population. And the Chinese are very sensitive to the fact that this ACE2 receptor is something, I don't know the whole, you know, sort of the biology of the cell, but the ACE2 receptor is something that the East Asians have that other populations don't have as much of. We all have, but not as much of. And so actually in one study that the Chinese have done, they actually look at these various populations. So they've looked at the African population, East Asia, South Asia, and Europe. And so, of course, the East Asia and South Asia is the reddest, meaning that it's the presence of the ACE2 receptor, those proteins, is highest. And the European is like zero. So in the beginning, the publisher and I were looking at, okay, so now where are the white people who are dying? Because it was clear that the Asians were dying, but were there any whites dying? And so it turns out that the first white who died without the underlying issues, you know, and complications. But I think the first white that died was in Italy. I think that's what I read. So if I were Chinese, and this is what I've tried to ask the Chinese, because I now not only do I teach in Bangladesh, but I've established a relationship with one of the universities in China, and I've asked them, you know, how dedicated to your revolution are you, and how dedicated to your people are you? Because I see the Chinese, I guess I need to get some water. I see the Chinese in all of these circles that are like dangerous circles. So the event 201, I don't know if you guys paid attention to event 201. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
So event 201 is the, you could call it a drill, is the drill that was done in October or November around a simulated coronavirus pandemic, and it ends up killing 65 million people. Well, what I found very interesting, I looked at all 4 hours of the simulation, and what I found interesting was that China was represented, but Russia was not. So I see China, and China gains access because China has all of this money, and I understand that. And you've got, you know, sort of the capitalist crowd over here just chasing after the money. But that can be intoxicating. And so I know the effect of colonialism, even though China on the mainland was not colonized, but parts of China were colonized, and parts of China you know, China has to live in the rest of the world. And so I understand the mentality that the colonized mentality that can result from these experiences. And so the question I have is for them that I have asked them time and time again is how committed to your revolution and your vision for your people are you, as opposed to living through Western eyes and Western lives?
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention one other thing. I don't know if it's worthy of any, well, it might be worthy of mention, if not actual inclusion, but that was just not arguing a case, but just noting that the Ebola outbreak a few years ago emerged around the immediate area surrounding the U.S. bioweapons lab in Sierra Leone, and that the Wuhan one emerged, even according to the U.S. or whatever, I think even the Chinese are saying it emerged 20 miles away from the bioweapons lab in Wuhan.
Well, this is the Chinese have said that, there were the Wuhan games, the military games there, and uh-huh. It's like Olympics, and so they take place every 4 years, and so you had soldiers from all over the world there, and the Chinese have said that were five soldiers. They did not name the countries of the soldiers, but that there were five soldiers who presented themselves at the hospital in Wuhan with a mysterious disease. So now that was enough to get some researchers going, and I just finished looking at about 3 hours of the work that George Webb, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he gathered a group of citizen researchers, and they holed up in a room. I guess they rented a place, a house, and they've been there 3 days. And they are researching this, and they have come up with a name. And the interesting thing is that the name that they've come up with just happens to be a part of the U.S. military. The husband is a part of the U.S. military, and assuming this is a brother, but they share the same last name, is the patient zero for the Netherlands, and one of the others is one of the other of this same family name traveled all over the world. And so remember the vaping, and they're linking him to the vaping. And I don't know exactly where George Webb and his group were going. Maybe it was that they were going around and making young people the carriers. And then as they circulated and continued to circulate it, that was how it went and landed in 200 countries. So anyway, they've got they call the name. The person is a woman bicyclist, and her last name is Benassi, Benassi. So you might want to take a look at the Benassi family and see what you can find on that. But it's a tremendous bit of work that I think George Webb and his group, there's about 8 or 10 of them. No, there's 8 of them because they can't have, they have to have 10 or fewer than 10. And it's a amazing work that they've been able to put together. And this is as late as today.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Richard, I'm going to just jump in here. Cynthia, I know you have a time limit here. Are you? We have 7 other people with questions. Are you able to take a few more? Or?
Yes, I'll take the 7.
Okay, great. All right, thank you, Richard, for those. Next up is Kat McGuire. Kat, go ahead.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you so much for taking your time to be with us. My name is Kat McGuire, and I first have a little thing, and then I'll ask my question. And that is, if you need or are interested in volunteer help, I'm a very good editor, and I helped Kevin Barrett edit 2 books, his Orlando book and From Yahweh to Zion. So I offer volunteer complimentary services as an editor if down the road you need that help. And you can get in touch with Cheryl or Craig to get my info.
Okay, I accept. I accept. So because maybe we can even beat the October 1 publication date, and that would be fabulous.
Okay, great. Well,
yeah.
You can reach out through Cheryl or Craig and get my email.
Okay.
Now, in terms of my question, one, we know that Rockefeller in 2010 had the whole lockstep seminar where they figured out how this virus might, how a pandemic might look. 2, we know Rockefeller has been following China since the days of Mao, and like we can't say a heavy hand, but they certainly have monitored with a form of glee the authoritarian form that this big society was going, with designs in mind for globalism. And 3, we know that they fund both sides, whoever we know who they fund both sides. So given that, at the highest levels, do you think China was a launch pad to launch it there to show that so that they could then say the authoritarian solution is the only way to go versus a more humanitarian herd immunization or herd immunization solution in order to get us at max vax, so that mass vaccinations, if not chips? So how much do you think that this was really orchestrated at the very highest level using China as the authoritarian template that now we all have to go that route?
Well, you've got a lot packed in that question. So let me talk about Event 201 and its sponsors. So they use Johns Hopkins. And, of course, now every one of us uses Johns Hopkins dashboard in order to see what the progress of the virus has been every day. And the Bill Gates and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was a sponsor of this, as well as the World Economic Forum. So you've got all of the bad guys in one place, and you've got Johns Hopkins there as well. And, of course, their record isn't too good when it comes to, what can I say, biological equity, or I guess I would say. So you've got all of these tainted entities, and they're carrying out. And not only are they carrying out these kinds of simulations, but they're also patenting various strains of coronavirus. And that is a reality. So now, in terms of governance system or governance structures, China has the authoritarian system. But that system has been one that has lifted 500 million people out of dire poverty. So it has performed for the Chinese people. Now, I don't know that, and of course the globalists, you're right, when I was in the Congress under the Clinton administration, I mean, it was like I visited China, I went to a manufacturing plant, and there was a gentleman there who was so excited because they were working on something that was like a secret weapon. It might have been, I can't remember where I was now, but it might have been one of the missile launching places. And when he said that it was secret technology, I said, well, we certainly don't want the Chinese to have secret technology, do we? And he said, oh, yes, we do. And so this policy that became U.S. policy of building up China through these technology transfers, that was carried out by the Clinton administration, and I think we've all kind of heard the stories about the satellite technology and other things that were transferred over to China at that time. So, of course, if you're the funding of both sides is definitely there, because there was a lot of funding, and U.S. corporations got tax breaks for moving their manufacturing operations over to China. So we know that that was a part of U.S. policy to do these things that now result in China becoming a powerhouse. So you're absolutely right about that. Now, and the idea that the quote-unquote globalists would love to have this sort of authoritarian, rigid control, population control, social control, I believe you're right on that as well. So now the question is, does China play along with that, or does China have its own ideas? And that's the question that I was asking the Chinese when I was there. I've only been there on this university campus twice, and that's what I keep asking, because I really don't know. When I see Event 201 take place and China is there and Russia is not there, what does that mean, and why is China there? And I know the deep pockets open a lot of doors for you, and it may just be that it's deep pockets, but there are many different political systems, and I'm not going to say that the U.S. political system is a better political system than the Chinese political system. What I will say is that any political system can be bad, and any political system can be good, depending on the quality of the people that you have inside and leading that system. And what we are experiencing is very poor quality in terms of the leadership of our system. And I'm not just talking about Trump. I'm talking about a whole lot of people that came before Trump. Not just talking about Xi, who I don't have a feel for one way or the other, but I do, you know, but the New Silk Road and all of the initiatives, I support those as ways to have a more peaceful and a more developed and a more connected world, but I do believe in sovereignty.
Okay. Great, thank you.
All right, thank you, Kat, for that question. Next on the list is Jessica Coco. Jessica, go ahead.
Oh, yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I have a question. Now, if you're going to create bio weapons that are real viruses or bacteria, they can mutate, and in that case, everyone could be exposed, including people who are wealthy. And there's all this talk going on about how there was 5G in Wuhan, and when the 5G was turned off, people got better. How there's the same thing in Italy. Do you see that this could be a possibility of some kind of biotech weapon as opposed to a biovirus? or
well,
combination?
Well, there definitely is a possibility, and I'm not the expert at 5G. But what I can tell you is that while I've been doing, I've read probably a dozen of these peer-reviewed articles about coronavirus and, you know, how it attaches and where it stays inside the body. And I've in the process of trying to get up to speed on that, and then it's impossible to ignore this 5G issue if you're listening to the – so I've listened to physicians who are talking about how 5G affects the human body, and it basically destroys your immune system and then opens up the possibility for a deeper infestation of these other toxins to come in and destroy the body. So with that understanding, then there is a connection between 5G if it is sort of, you know, suppressing the immune system. And if that's what it does, then we're in for a world of trouble. So that's not something that I get into in the book, but it is something that I've come across in just my readings about the coronavirus itself. There are some people who have looked specifically at this connection. And one of those is a researcher by the name of Derek Broz, B as in boy, R-O-Z, or Z-E, and he has done extensive research on this and has a lot of internet presence on that topic.
I'm sorry, you said it's Derek Broz?
Uh-huh, Derek Broz.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. And Cynthia, I believe our next speaker, Renee Parsons, may be addressing that somewhat, so just so you know.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Jessica. Malcolm Arnold, you're next. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Cynthia. Just a couple quick comments and then a question. So I went to an academic multidisciplinary conference on the Spanish flu a couple of years ago, and they were talking about where it originated. They said, you know, Belgium or, you know, China or Kansas. And I went and I looked and did some research on Kansas, and it seemed to me that the United States had a bioweapons program years before it was admitted, and that probably was a bioweapons release accidental. There's actually now, I just looked up, and there seems to be more research on that on the Internet since I researched a couple of years ago as we were talking on the phone. So you may want to look at that. And then also, we use biological weapons in the North Korean War. There's documentation on that, so there's precedence as far as that's pretty well documented. And I'm kind of curious as to if you know about this report that I just found out about today that they did in Germany in 2012. It was basically a white paper exercise on what would happen if a pandemic virus hit Germany, and it was put out by the Bundestag. I can send you the information through Barbara because I have her email address. But basically, this whole paper, I think it's about 80 pages, goes through what would be the economic aspects that would hit, the political, et cetera, et cetera. And they specifically mentioned that it would be a coronavirus for the exercise. And this is in 2012. And this video that I just watched today with Walter Veith, V-E-I-T-H, and Martin Smith, it's called What's Up, Prof? Coronavirus, Noah Hyde Laws. And what it also deals with, he deals with a variety of subjects, but one of the things is that in your economic perspectives as far as economics and using this as an economic warfare and stuff. The one thing that you don't cover is using this as a religious warfare and the connection to coronavirus. So I don't know if about, you know about the Noahide laws. I just learned about them, but I know about Chabad. But they actually passed laws in the U.S. that aren't part of the Constitution. Supposedly Bush passed them. But if you suspend the constitutional law through martial law, these laws actually might supersede that, which I've never heard this put forth before, but he puts that forth in that video. But what's really interesting is also that report that he talks about. He speaks fluent German, but he goes through that report, and it seems like that report would be very much important to your book.
Okay. If you could send me the links and the references, that would be wonderful. I am devouring this stuff, and I would love to devour that. I have heard about the Noahide laws, but I don't exactly know what they are, even though I've had, I think his name is Stephen Ben Israel from Israeli News Live, actually try to explain to me what they are, but I don't know what they are. And if we have something on the books that I need to know about in that regard, then this would be a wonderful way for me to get that in. And this idea of religious warfare, you're right, it's not there. And it doesn't mean that the people who might be involved in all of this don't have religious views. And just because I shouldn't even call myself secular, since I went to elementary and high school, almost went to college at Catholic institution. But in the U.S., we're pretty secular, and but that doesn't mean that the rest of the world is like us, and they are, in fact, not. In fact, when I went to Russia, I was asked what my religion was, and when I all over Asia, that's a question that you get a lot. What's your religion? So it does mean something to other people. So you're right that I do need to pay some attention to this religious aspect, and I will do so. When it comes to the previous use by the United States of biological toxins as a weapon of war, we did that. They did that in North Korea against the North Koreans and against China. You're right that
testing domestically in the subway systems as far as spreading of biological agents to see how they would spread, and people did die.
Well, actually, and you know, they tested in California. They did that. They were spraying people in California to see what the reaction was. And of course, I don't even have to get into the Tuskegee, the whole, you know, sort of the CDC thing and Guatemala, and, you know, how they have allowed diseases to proliferate in certain populations, not for the purpose of studying, but for the purpose of debilitating those populations. So, yeah, the United States is definitely experienced at using biological agents as a weapon of war, and I hope to be able to establish that this is not an alien notion for the current people who control the U.S. deep state, nor the past, the previous ones either. So you'll get me the information on the Noahide laws, though.
Yeah, if I also can just make a comment, and Barbara, I hope I'm not outing anything, because you mentioned it in a previous conversation that we had on this telephone line when I talked about how when they were doing the Manhattan Project and they were going to explode the atomic bombs, there were a couple of scientists who said that if you explode the atomic bomb, you'll ignite the atmosphere and destroy the planet. And my question was, is that when you had conventional air superiority of Japan, and you also had naval superiority, and you could just surround them and blockade them, which is a very, you know, age-old strategic tactic, at what point do you make the risk assessment that, okay, we're going to risk destroying the entire planet to win the war against Japan, when obviously they're not really a threat to our shores, and we can win it conventionally. So to me, there seems like there must be something going on that's not just non-religious, right? There's not just power,
yeah.
Not just money. There has to be something else that I'm not putting my finger on. And Barbara said there's actually quite a few scientists that were who had that. She knew that. She confirmed it. And there were quite a few scientists. If you want to weigh in on that, Barbara, give that information to Cynthia.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask that you guys give it to her offline because we have four more people and another speaker. So if that's okay with everyone.
Yeah.
If I could just respond, I'd just like to say that I always bring up the Samson option because we could be dealing with people who are most willing to destroy the planet in order to, if they feel that they are going down themselves.
Hmm.
And with that, you know what happened with Netanyahu. So Netanyahu was on his way to the courtroom for his corruption, and as a result of coronavirus, he's disbanded the court.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I hadn't heard that. Wow. All right, so thank you, Malcolm, for that question. We're going to move on here. Barry Zwicker, you're next. Go ahead.
Oh, Barry. Oh, my gosh.
Hi. Yeah,
it's
Barry
Zwicker. On. Oh, wow.
I met you, I think, in Washington, D.C. around 2006.
Okay.
And, and my memory is not dependable on the time and place, but my memory is 100% reliable that I became an instant admirer of yours. And
oh, and I'm
I've
an
heard,
instant
read.
Admirer of yours, too. Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, I did watch, you know, the work of the group about Maddie Benassi and so on, and it's
okay.
quite instructive. I wonder if you had seen the work under DigiLeak. It's F. William Engdahl. Engdahl. He's done a lot of good work, and he has written a piece about coronavirus and the Gates Foundation. Now, I read about Event 201 in his article, and I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to be brief. It's unusual for me, but I'm going to try to be briefer than the other questioners. So
okay.
One is that I'm not assuming or projecting or suggesting that the Gates Foundation or Bill and Melinda are evil or have any particular motives, but they have been very concerned about pandemics for some time, so I'm just interested in what you do think about them. The second question has to do with this, and this is, gets down more to brass tacks, Cynthia. Ourworlddata.org, I think it's a pretty good source, and so if there's a group that's targeted by this, I think we can put aside nationality and race and so forth, because, for instance, the deaths, this is the deaths by age groups in China, and this is also followed in Italy, and it's following in other countries. The death rate among people 40 to 49 is 0.4%. Among people 50 to 59, it's 1.3%. People 60 to 69, it's 3.6%. People between 70 and 79, it's 8%. And people who are 80 plus, it's 14.8%. Now, it's mainly older people who are dying. I will be 87 in November. I'm in a high-risk group also because I'm male, and the male mortality rate is a bit greater than the female. And also, I have COPD. So people who are male over 80 and have a respiratory issue, we are in the greatest risk. So I'm not I don't know what to think about that, except that I've got to be damn careful right here in Ontario, Canada, and I'm, trying to make sure I don't touch a handrail without washing my hands. But anyway, I have the two questions
about
Bill and Melinda Gates, and secondly, about the people who are actually at the greatest risk in every country right now, which is people like me.
You're absolutely right. And the Chinese also have discovered something else. Now, of course, I think you guys probably saw Professor Boyle's interviews that he did. And if you didn't, let me know, and I'll sort of recap. You saw them. Okay.
I regret that I myself have not seen Professor Boyle.
Okay. Well, basically what he does is, not paying attention to his conclusion, which I disagree with, but what he does is he provides us the studies that have been done on coronaviruses, starting with the Australia study in 2010, where they were playing around with SARS coronavirus and HIV. And remember, early on, the idea was that the HIV drugs worked. And then you had the Indian study that was published in February of 2020, that said that when they sequenced it all out, that, yeah, there were four HIV-like inserts. And so now the Indian scientists who wrote that paper were forced to withdraw the paper. But then I believe it was the Chinese, there was another paper that was done after the Indian paper was withdrawn that concurred with the Indian finding. So then the medical personnel who were exposed in China began to take remdesivir, which is produced by Gilead Sciences, which is Donald Rumsfeld's company. And that's why you've heard that name mentioned a lot. I bet that there's not a single person that's been on the stage, maybe not Trump, but all of those old public health hands, they probably all are invested in Gilead, and so you get them talking about Gilead a lot. And so not only do they have to worry about that demographic that you mentioned, but they also, because I don't know if it's true or if it's not true, but we've got the one withdrawn study and we've got the Chinese study that was not withdrawn that agreed with the finding of the HIV, and we've got the use of HIV drugs successfully in China. So we've got that. And then there was a finding from one Chinese study that found that it attaches to the testis, and the Chinese now are worried about sterility in the men. Now, of course, what does that get me back to is the whole Gates Foundation, because in those vaccines that I think it was Kenyan doctors found sterilizing agents in the vaccines that were provided for the women in Kenya, and they were provided by the Gates Foundation. Of course, you've had problems with the vaccines in India, such that the Indian government has decided that they will just kind of they didn't kick them out, but they basically kicked them out and said, we're going to handle vaccinations on our own. You've also got the situation in China where they recently passed a law that governs the administration of their vaccinations. So they've got a scheme now where they will pay if there's harm done to a Chinese citizen as a result of a mandatory vaccination. But the Chinese government has decided that they are going to take over vaccinations. And so this could also have been a motivation for hitting China so hard, because China was kicking Big Pharma out. That's one thing. So the Gates Foundation, just if we look at, there's one researcher, I can't remember his name, but when he talks about eugenics, he says the Nazis got their eugenics program from the U.S. And, of course, we know that Bill Gates' father was a part of that. So the eugenics agenda, vaccination agenda are definitely, if they're not a part of this, they could very well be an outcome of this, and that's what we have to pay attention to.
Well, there was the in William Engdahl's piece in mm-hmm. DigiLeak, he mentions that Dr. Anthony Fauci, he's the person at the center of the Trump administration virus emergency response, has been connected with Fauci-Gates Moderna coronavirus vaccine. That's mRNA-1273. So he comes from that corporate scientific group, and he's the main he shows up on TV besides Trump, and he sort of mildly differs with Trump a bit, but he's at the top. It's hard to know what game he's playing.
Well, I just put on my Twitter feed the other day that Dr. Fauci is the swamp. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, that kind of hit my mom. My mom was an emergency nurse, and she was in charge of the largest hospital in my state, which, of course, is the same home state for the CDC. So there's not very many of those doctors that she didn't practice with. And so we kind of were proud a long time ago of Dr. Fauci, because he was kind of like homegrown, and even though he's not from Georgia or anything, but, you know, kind of homegrown. And my mom knew him, but it was very difficult for me to say he's the swamp. But from everything I've seen, the 2015 University of North Carolina study was financed by National Institutes of Health, and that was a study to make coronavirus, SARS coronavirus, more lethal. That's the gain of function study that Professor Boyle talks about. I've read them all. And, it's financed by the National Institutes of Health. Now, why are they studying that? How to make viruses more lethal? So anyway, I think ultimately in the end, and this is where I'm going to basically conclude in the book, that all of these level 3 and level 4 bio labs that are financed by the U.S. and its allies need to either be disbanded, or there needs to be 100% transparency in what it is that they're actually researching and studying.
Good for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Good for you.
Barry, appreciate that. Okay. Next we have James Hufford. James, go ahead.
Well, my question was pretty well answered already, but I would like to thank Cynthia for being with us, and also to comment that that the half of the motivation, other than elite profits and desire to be Atlas astride the world, is that America has always been extremely, extremely xenophobic, and also has been jealous of anybody that challenged it for leadership. They're not going to. They weren't. Iran was practically a first world country before the U.S. Couldn't stand that and turned them over, and that's why Iran is so mad at the U.S. still today. And if you remember way back, in the 17th century with the from the Mohawks and the King Philip's War and all that, there's just this streak of xenophobia that leads to genocide in the American elite makeup, and that's what's got to change before the world can recover, I think.
Yes, I absolutely agree that we've got a lot of healing that we need to do.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I don't know, it's a big job that remains undone.
Well, the sad part is that, or I guess the happy part is that the people are not like that. It's the elite strain, I can't think what it's called, this branch civilization. They've got their own civilization going with completely opposite values to ordinary people in this country. And they're scared to death of us, that they sometimes it slips through from the elite that they demonize us, even their
yes.
own countrymen. They look at us as a foreign country, and that
yes.
they're the rightful rulers. And we've got to take, I mean, this is a trite term, but it's true, we've got to take it back.
I know. I know.
All right, thank you, James. Appreciate that. Next up is Anthony Hall. Go ahead, Anthony.
Hi, Tony.
Tony, are you there? Did Tony hang up already? Let's see. No, he's on.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Tony.
Yeah, hi. Okay, well, Barbara Honegger gave a bit of an introduction to what I think is crucial. And I think connecting the situation we see now to 9/11, it's a very opportune moment for that. We didn't get a handle on 9/11, and all these emergency measures were brought in. And, you know, now people can see the implications of
yes.
Being careless or not being insistent that we need some honest evaluation of what's going on. Now, I think in this situation with epidemiology, there is a kind of dynamic where the truth seems to want to come out, because the the methodology of epidemiologists is to go to the origins, you know, to find
yes.
the patient zero. And so,
right.
you know, the Chinese
right.
are talking about that, and Trump doesn't want to talk about it. But it looks like we're getting a patient zero. I think the Benassi cyclist woman from Fort Belvoir might be part of it. But there's
yes.
been a big revelation. Godfrey Roberts in UNS and in American Herald Tribune publishes a list from a person called Thomas Han Wing Poulin from Hong Kong. And apparently the U.S. team was training in the area of Fort Detrick, where George
mm-hmm.
Webb and company, I think they're in that area now. And he makes it clear that this group that went from the Fort Detrick area, the U.S. team, which came in 35th, they didn't have much interest in doing athletics. It seems they had an interest in something else. They stayed at a place called, and this is just came out hours ago, the Oriental Hotel near the Level 4 lab in the Wuhan market in that area, and 42 people got infected at that hotel. And those five people who got infected, and we learned about this from Romanoff's articles in Global Research.
What's the name of the...
The hotel is the Oriental Hotel. Anyway, he speaks of 45 people at that hotel getting sick, five Americans getting sick. People in George Webb's group, you know, they talk about this Benassi woman getting sick when she went back to Virginia. It's possible that they were training at Fort Belvoir. But now it's just coming to be taken for granted among Chinese people that it has a U.S. origin, and the evidence is becoming much greater.
That it has what?
The evidence is just becoming much greater. We might call it, you know, the Fort Detrick virus.
Yes, I got you.
The Fort Detrick is closed down that summer. There's some kind of business going on, accidental stuff. So what happens when you close down a lab? The lab, which, by the way, was probably the source for the anthrax. And, you know, there
That's is right.
a bio-weapon attack, inside job on Congress, you know, a bioweapon attack on Congress, which was directed specifically at Daschle and Leahy, people who were going to question the Patriot Act. So
that's right.
So
or more.
People are on the mind to see the connections with 9/11 and see how dangerous it is to allow something of this magnitude to go through, to be fed a false story, to be allow it to be that anybody who has a different narrative must be demonized and called names and called conspiracy theorists. I've never seen that word so much used as is now the case on mainstream, you know, which really think that they have some right to just regulate the discussion and put it in their framework. So really integrating the story of 9/11 and seeing this as an outcome of it, or as an extension of it. And I think the Soleimani attack in January on Iran and what's going on now in Iran, and I don't know if you've run into this researcher Danny Shoham, the Israeli biological warfare expert who is doing a lot of research in India on the Chinese biowarfare system. It's kind of like this agent of the Israel biological warfare system is pointing at China, kind of like we saw people pointing at Muslims after 9/11, and a whole chorus of voices demonizing Muslims as the culprits of 9/11. And I've seen the same sort of tendency towards from Israeli sources towards China, to demonize China. So let's really get creative and insist, and I think really we can invoke the 9/11 story as we understand it right now with really much more credibility than the people who have been calling us names for 20 years, that there is an openness to understand this type of interpretation that we've been developing, and this current situation, whether it happened inadvertently or by design, but it's clearly being exploited as if it's by design to bring in things that would make what, you know, we've been facing, the emergency measures we've been facing for 20 years since 9/11, look like small potatoes, look like kindergarten in comparison to what they seem to have in mind for us now.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And that last chapter is the chapter in which we look at what kind of world, what's the post-coronavirus world look like. So we definitely need to include the 911 parallel, the anthrax and all of that. So I accept that, and that's going to happen.
Yeah. And if you get a chance, you might have a look at who or what started the Wuhan coronavirus epidemic by Hall. It got out pretty well in the last few weeks, an essay here and there on the Internet. Okay.
Oh, well, then please send it to me.
Yeah. Anyway, it's easy to find it. Anthony Hall, who or what started the Wuhan coronavirus epidemic? And I'll leave it at that. And thank you so much for all your work as usual.
Okay, thank you, Tony. Larry Fine, you're next. I just unmuted you. Go ahead.
It's actually Susan Serpa. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, Cynthia. This is Susan Serpa in Massachusetts.
How are you?
Oh, fine, yes. Oh,
it's
so
been a long time.
Yeah, we worked together on the Citizens Campaign Commission for Ballot Initiative. And my question is unrelated to your book. I'm really excited to read your book once it's done. But it's unrelated to the virus. Since we did work on the campaign together and everything unraveled when Mike Gravel left and you became the figurehead and... background noise. Anyway, you had mentioned at the time that ballot initiative was not really the way to go, that a grand jury was the way to go. I don't know if you recall saying that.
Yes, I remember distinctly because I had been in... Baltimore, which is a citizen grand jury state, and it had come up there. And, of course, it made a lot of sense. And so I said, well, let's do it. But, of course, you know, doing it is a lot more difficult than saying it. But I think you guys have actually done it.
Well, this is why I bring up the question.
Mm-hmm.
They're working. Barbara and David Misswinkle, and you know, they're working really hard on this grand jury, but it's taking forever, and it seems to be impeded by secrecy quite a bit. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on how on earth can a grand jury really work when it's so shrouded with secrecy.
Yeah, you know, the way it works is that we've got to elect people to office. I mean, so that we can basically control what's going on. And if we had more members of Congress who were willing to ask some tough questions, we could get answers that way. If we had district attorneys that were elected that would ask questions and allow for, you know, in those grand jury states, then we could be assured. We have a situation here in Georgia. You might have heard of the missing and murdered children. Mm. It was a phenomenon that was taking place in Atlanta in the 1980s. And basically what they did was they sent an innocent man to prison, and he's been in prison ever since. And they're supposed to be, we have a friendly grand, a friendly district attorney. He's supposed to be conducting an investigation by way of a grand jury, and it's just taken forever, and it's already taken forever, knowing that this man is in prison and he's not even guilty. So if we had better people in office, we could change the rules by which the system operates. Until we actually revolutionize the system by taking it over, this is what we're going to get. And, you know, we're kind of stuck with it. We're stuck with it. And there's got to be something that we can do. Now, I have an idea about organizing state by state, but, you know, I was honest when I was in the Congress, which means that I have to work. And
So that consequently, no university would hire me in the U.S., and so I had to leave. And I was able to sort of make my way and be very happy and appreciate it in another part of the world. But it shouldn't be that way. And you know, I don't know what it would take to open up the eyes of people. Maybe this coronavirus and what the pre-narrative has always been and the action, maybe people will see a disconnect and will say, okay, well, they said they couldn't do it, and now they're doing it here, so that maybe we need to take control. I don't know what it will take to open up people's eyes.
Okay, thank you very much for that one. Cynthia, we have one last question, and Nita, if you could keep it really brief, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, Cynthia. My name is Nita Renfrew. I live in New York, and I was once a journalist until I found out you couldn't really make a living if you wrote the truth.
Yes.
I have a question. I assume you saw the Newsweek article last week about the military's top secret plans if coronavirus cripples the government to enact the continuity of government.
Yes, I did see it. I did not read it. And, you know, deep state and all that stuff is my thing, so I guess I better pull it out if they're talking about continuity of government.
Well, it seems to me that they're floating this in order to get it out there, because they actually have a box in the middle of the article which asks, should emergency continuity of government plans be enacted? And you can respond, yes, no, or I don't know.
Mm.
And I was going to ask you, what are the chances that they could actually get away with this?
They've gotten away with everything else,
well,
including killing a president in broad open daylight.
But this continuity of government, they're actually saying it would put NORTHCOM in command with General Terrence O'Shaughnessy. So he would take the place of Trump, and they would suspend the Constitution. It's like a long article.
Well, I need to look at it. But I mean, you know, that there have been people who have been trying to the Democratic Party has become. I mean, it's worse than the Republican Party. In my opinion.
Yeah.
And the Democratic Party is only able to remain alive because you've got this mass of black voters out there that just pull that D.
Mm.
And they don't care who the person is behind the D. And so I've even begun to think about, oh, my gosh, maybe the problem with democracy is too many people participate. I mean, you know, it's just like it's unbelievable where we are and how far the Democratic Party has sunk in. But anyway, it is what it is, and they've been, you know, the way I have sort of watched this unfold is that you can say whatever you want to say about Trump. The bottom line is he's not one of them.
Yeah.
And because he's not one of them, then this is a fight to the death that we're watching and that we're participating in. As spectators and as victims. So this fight to the death, this is a part of it. And there's a part of me that says that this whole coronavirus is impeachment 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Anita, for your question. Okay. And Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you guys, I mean, let me just tell you that we wouldn't be as far along as we are on 911 Truth were it not for you, because, you know, at the end of the day, you are the researchers and you are the investigators and you are the people who were not satisfied with half-truths and half-answers. And you did what it took in order to get us closer to the truth. So you guys are the heroes, and I'm just happy that I've been reconnected with you, that I'm back in the United States. I don't know for how long, but at least while I'm here, I need to do a better job of staying connected with you guys.
Sounds great. We like that.
Yeah, so thank you so much.
Yes, thank you again. And I will connect you to the people on the call who wanted your email, so we'll do that.
Okay.
And you're welcome to stay on. I know you had a limited time, and we were already way over that, so
yes.
You need to go.
Okay, and I'll talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, so I'm going to put everyone in. Okay, and then I'm going to, let's see, unmute our speakers, and let me just find everybody here. All right. All right, Ann, you're unmuted. And let me find Renee here. And Renee, now you're unmuted, and Ann, if you would be so kind as to introduce Renee for us.
Sure, thank you. Renee Parsons has been a member of the ACLU's Florida State Board of Directors and president of the ACLU Treasure Coast Chapter. She's been an elected public official in Colorado, an environmental lobbyist with Friends of the Earth, and a staff member at the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. Renee is also a student of the quantum field. She is a frequent contributor to global research. Thanks, Renee, for talking with us tonight.
Thanks. It's actually Renee. It's a nickname for Irene.
So, okay.
It looks like Renee.
All right.
That's fine. It looks like Renee, but it's really Renee. But whatever. I'm used to, you know, people calling me just about anything. I'm sorry Cynthia didn't stay because I'm really going to link the 5G and coronavirus. And I think she would have been interested in some of this. But I'm going to make this really brief because at least at my end, the audio is deteriorating. So, and it's late in the hour, and I'm sure people are getting ready to sack out for the night. China was not at Event 201. They were not invited to Event 201, which is interesting in itself, isn't it? And I wanted to talk about, Wuhan is in the Hubei province of China, and that city is it's what's called a smart city. And they're the only smart city, I think in the world. I think it's the most developed smart city in the world. And what that means is that it is thoroughly, totally, and completely wired for 5G. Everything that can be wired is wired. And so it's so interesting then that they had this reaction to the virus. And the virus did not spread at all in the same contagious way outside of that Hubei province. So there's a connection with the 5G. And another one is the Evergreen Health Hospital in Kirkland, Washington, which up until a few days ago, and I don't know if this has changed or not, but up until a few days ago, they had the highest mortality rate in the country. Evergreen is the only hospital in the country that is wired for 5G. And the last I knew, which is now maybe 3 or 4 days ago, one of their ER doctors was in critical condition. So there's a connection there. There's definitely a connection there, and I would hope that Cynthia would think about, I didn't hear her say that she was going to have a chapter in her book about the connection between 5G and coronavirus, but that's really critical. That has to happen. At least the research on it has to happen. And then Gates, our friend Bill Gates, is a part owner in a company or a foundation called PIPBright, and they own the patent for coronavirus. So Gates, of course, is up to his eyeballs and all of this kind of stuff. But I wanted to also just tell you a little bit about Sergeant First class Benassi, because she is in a particularly interesting role at Fort Detrick. She is assigned to the Intel Command at the facility as a diplomatic security officer and a designated driver. She's a designated driver for the NATO. She has been a designated driver for the NATO Supreme Allied Command, which means she is also a courier, which means she also passes through customs with no search. And so Fort Detrick is well known for its role in being able in biological material. It's an it's a BSL 4 lab, which is the highest grade for the kind of weapons research that they do in the country. And it's a huge campus. I think it's an 8,000 acre campus. They have almost as many employees at Fort Detrick as are at the Pentagon. So it's a very sophisticated facility in lots of ways. And the other thing I wanted to mention about, there's also on what came to me, I wrote the story about Benassi and just this whole thing about the possibility of the U.S. involvement, because 300, as was mentioned earlier, 300 American military people attended that world military Olympic contest. And five people were, from my reading, my research, I got a lot of this information also from George Webb, by the way, but from my reading, five people became infected with corona eventually. And so there are patients 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I'm guessing that the military or the government is not doing really anything to try to track Benassi or those other four people who were infected while they were in Wuhan. But she also, what was there something else I wanted to tell you about her? Somebody mentioned earlier about her cousin Benny. Now that's really interesting also, because he was designated the first person in Holland to be confirmed infected with coronavirus. Now where did he get that from? Did she travel up there? So where these four people traveled, where they went after they left Wuhan is really interesting. It's well thought, I think, at this point that both Italy, for some reason, Italy and Iran both received more virulent strands of the virus. And all five strands are at Fort Detrick. All five strands of the coronavirus are at Fort Detrick. Only three of those strands are in China, and that's apparently a really significant piece of information as well. And let me think. I guess that was in a nutshell, I think, that I wanted to mention. So I think there's a lot more to this story that obviously has not become public yet, and I think that the Chinese are going to, they've already, of course, denied that they had any role, and they're asking for, as rightly they should, they're asking for the U.S. to do some testing. And I think, I have next to no hope that the U.S. is going to take the lead on any of this or try to show any complicity, of course, on their part. And I'm more concerned about people like Pompeo using this as an excuse to make war with China, and whether it's trade war or military war, but to really destroy our relationship, what had been built with China over this, and being able to prove the government, really U.S. government, needs to be able to prove that it in fact did come from China. And we really don't know that. And so there's a lot of those kinds of questions that need to be asked and looked at and talked about.
Okay, thank you. Rini, did I say that right? Q&A mode. And so people, if you'd like to ask a question, it's star 6, as you know. And while we're waiting, I want to ask you, do you have any sense of, I know this might not be your field of expertise, but, you know, our economy was predicted to be collapsing, and, you know, we were going to go into at least a recession, if not another Great Depression. Do you think there's any way that they are using this to cover that up so that people will think our economy is crashing because of the virus? Just curious. And do I have you muted? Let me just see again. Yes, okay. You're now unmuted. Thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah, you know, I was just listening to Dylan Bradigan. I don't know if you ever listened to Jimmy Dore, who is occasionally, who is occasionally worth listening to, actually. He does some very funny satirical political commentary, and he had Dylan Bradigan on, and apparently this law that they're passing, or no, it's the Fed Bank that is coming up with $14 trillion. That's their package, $14 trillion. $4 trillion for the banks, $6 trillion for the businesses, and $4 trillion for loan guarantees. And that, now this is not answering your question, but it's just fascinating, isn't it, how the financial industry somehow benefits out of all this chaos. And the other thing that Bradigan mentioned that I thought was interesting is that in 2008, there was a congressional vote, and I remember it well, and you probably do too, in terms of voting to allow the Fed to give the banks the money. And they did away after that vote, and then that failed, if you remember. That vote failed, and then they had to take a second vote, and then that vote passed. And so since that time, that understanding, whether it was an actual law or not, I'm not sure, because obviously the Fed doesn't report to the Congress at all. I mean, they do, but not really. So that law or that understanding has been done away with, so that's not going to happen. So there's not going to be any kind of congressional oversight whatsoever on $14 trillion.
Wow.
Pretty incredible. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And it's just all happening, you know, right under our noses and under the guise of this terrible crisis that's going on.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Nita, you're first on the list to ask a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm Nita Renfrew in New York City. I just wanted to add some information that I have heard that I haven't seen anywhere else from two sources that in northern regarding the situation in Italy. In northern Italy, some years ago, the Chinese bought up a lot of the textile factories and the leather goods factories, and they brought in 300,000 Chinese people to work in them, is what I'm being told. And these people, and there's a direct flight from Milan to Wuhan, and these people go back and forth between Wuhan, and a lot of them go back when there's the Chinese New Year, which is lasts for about 15 days in January. So that's the reason for the big amount of coronavirus in northern Italy, and that somebody should really investigate that because it's it explains a lot. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you for that. You know, I did include that in my very first article called More Than Just a Virus. Because the Chinese and the Italians have had a trade agreement since 2016. Mm-hmm. And there's other connections, Oh, I know. It was that Italy, I think, was the only country to, what was it now? It's beyond me. They were the only country of the G7 or whatever that group is to work with China on something. And I forgot what the detail of it is now. but they have a very close relationship, apparently. So I thought that was interesting. And then, of course, Iran, we all know, you know, the situation in Iran, especially with some of the Iranian government officials being targeted, I think, and suffering immediately in the early days from infection.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kat, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Kat McGuire. Thank you so much, Renee, for being on. One thing I just want to point out, which I'm sure you know or I read, and you can maybe verify it, that in September 2019, Italy released a brand new vaccine for flu. So I'm wondering to what extent that is at play. And then my bigger question has to do with vaccines vis-a-vis 5G. And thank you for reminding me. I've got to watch Derek Broz's stuff. There's a good interview James Corbett has with Derek Broz that in my long list of things to get to read, and I will. Thank you, Renee, for telling me that. But just your opinion, do you think we know they're going to load these vaccines up with all kinds of cocktails, could be time deaths, oh, you're 60, we're going to get rid of you by 72 years old. do you think that are they going to be able to use 5G as a programming device, if you will, for your vaccines? It's not a chip yet, but can the vaccine be programmed almost like a chip itself?
Oh, I don't know about that, but I do know that there is talk of the vaccine being untested. They're just going to take something right from the lab, and you know that's probably already a done deal, and put it out into the public. That's what I've been hearing anyway. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that, you know, Italy has the second oldest population in the planet, right behind Japan.
Uh-huh.
So that's
but you haven't, you're not really aware of vaccines at this point being able to be programmed or activated or whatever with 5G.
No, I'm not. But I am aware of, let me see if I can find it here. It's called nanotubes, and it is this little gizmo, and I have it in a link to in one of my in my last article, I think. And it contains, if I could find it. Oh, there it is. Hold on a second. Yeah, it's called a nanotube coronavirus delivery system, and it's a weaponized 5G package. And the interesting thing in looking at the diagram, just as I was sitting here listening just this evening, is that I see that it says that the patent, there's a patent on it, and it's by Anonymous. And that kind of flashes red lights to me like U.S. government, you know?
Could you say again the name of that? Nano something coronavirus. Say that name, please.
Yeah, it's a nanotube coronavirus delivery system. And it's a weaponized 5G. And that's what I think happened in, for instance, in Evergreen at the hospital there, is that there's some that connection between the virus and the 60 gigahertz or higher in the millimeter range on the electromagnetic spectrum that triggers. And I think there's some research going on. You can find information on the net about this as well, that's being looked at as well, that the 5G and the coronavirus, for some reason, have this dynamic connection. And I could read to you if you wanted me to. But anyway, it's a nanocapsulation for drug delivery. And so this one, though, is for a weaponized 5G wireless coronavirus delivery system. And the interesting thing on this patent, it says it was patented anonymously on March 21st, 2020. Yeah. So what is that about? So I think there's a lot to know about that. So, but I can't answer your question specifically about the 5G.
Okay, thanks. Keep up the great work.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Kat. Okay, James Hufford, you're next. Go ahead.
Okay, James Hufford. And first of all, I'd like to say that I've read your current article in two versions today, and I think it's close to being the most illuminating thing I've read about the coronavirus. I thank you very much for your research and writing those articles.
Thank you.
Keep it up. Now,
thank you. Where did you, can I ask you, James, where you read them?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to look that up.
Okay, I'm always interested because I never know. You used to be able to, you know, whenever you published an article, it used to be that I could put in the title, I could Google the title, and bingo,
yeah,
there would be the list of the places,
yeah,
where it's being run.
I
can't do that anymore. Yeah. Anyway,
see.
Go ahead.
Well, maybe I have it here. Renee Parsons, the title is Did the U.S. Bug Wuhan? And Who Are the Wuhan Five?
Wuhan Five, yeah.
One of the titles. Anyway.
And where was that? Do you know?
Let's see.
No.
Let's see.
That's
I can bring it up.
That's all
right. Quick here.
That's all right.
It says Madhouse News. Does that ring a bell?
Oh yeah. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
That's that. And I read another article that had a lot of the same text in it, but it was different also.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't
know.
Hey,
Dave, do you have a question?
Sure. Oh, do I have a question? No, I had a comment to answer something that you brought up before about the possibility that what they're doing by blaming continually 24 hours a day blaming China for the virus.
Mm-hmm.
I just read today that the Marines, the 800 or so Marines that were just that Trump just sent to the Middle East, that they were pulled back now and they're being changed from land warfare to naval warfare. And I imagine that 800 of those aren't going to make much difference, but they're being trained for deployment in the South China Sea. And I imagine that number, that small, piddly number in the Middle East, was for training purposes. And I imagine that their mission will be to train the naval forces that might be involved if the neocons get their way and they go to war with China in the South China Sea. So
yeah,
that's just something I read today.
Yeah, well, watch for that to heat up, I think. As soon as this immediate crisis dies down,
right,
they'll switch gears, and and Trump has already been talking about the China virus.
That's right. Well, we need to do, maybe we can't do anything, but we need to do what we can, this group and our influence, to try to turn that around, to inform people to oppose it. Because I don't think there's much opposition to anything they're doing at this point.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons, James, that I was writing about the Wuhan Five.
Sure.
And about Sergeant Wabasi. What's her name? Wabasi. Because until people realize that, well, wait a minute, this was probably another false flag. This could have been another false flag kind of.
Yeah. No, I assume it is so. Yeah. I think Barbara Honegger was exactly right about that in her article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I'm posting all of these fine articles on my website, 9/11 Grassroots, if you want to look them up. There's just a whole slew of them, probably a hundred of them, and you can find them all in one place there. And
great.
I don't know
thank
any
you
other
that
place on the web where you can find that concentration of information on this subject or any other subjects.
Right. Thank you for that.
Sure. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, James, thank you. Let's see. I just wanted to check in with Craig. Do you have any? I know you can't get on the list in the queue. Do you have any questions, or are you all set?
Yes. Right. No. I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Renee, very much for your presentation. I'm sorry that we were so late tonight, and
okay,
I'm hoping
thanks
that you. I'll come on back. You'll come back again and fill us in a little bit more at another date. So
yeah,
we'll
okay.
keep in touch.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Let me just
bye,
get us
thanks.
Out of here.
Bye.
Okay, so if you want to all unmute yourself, it's star 6 right now. And we're going to go into announcements, or you can stay muted, whatever you like. You're free to do that. So Bonnie Faulkner is with us, and she had an announcement to make. She's going to tell us about, and I'm going to unmute you, Bonnie. Okay, you're unmuted. Bonnie, did you want to tell us about the vote at Pacifica?
Oh, yes. This is Bonnie Faulkner. I can tell you about it very briefly. There was yet another in a whole series of attempted takeovers of the Pacifica radio network here in the United States. This was a court-ordered, a group of attorneys and others had tried to completely change the Pacifica bylaws, eliminate all the station boards, the separate radio stations have their each have their own board, and then there's a national board. And so the proposal was to eliminate all the station boards and the national boards, and then a select group of people, we don't really even know who, would appoint people to run Pacifica. Anyway, there was a court-ordered vote on it, and it was defeated by the staff voted and also listeners voted, and it was defeated. About two-thirds of the voters were voting no, and about one-third voted yes. So it was defeated. About just under 10,000 people voted, I believe. So this little drama is over with. But, of course, Pacifica is in terrible shape. But the there was a lot of attorneys involved in this, progressive activist attorneys, Peter Frank, Carol Spooner, Dan Siegel in Oakland. There's a whole slew of them. It's basically Democratic Party politics, but then there's a cabal surrounding KPFA in Berkeley that's orchestrated a lot of this. A few months ago, they illegally shut down the New York station, WBAI. They came in, they fired everybody. It was all illegal. Took their equipment down, et cetera. Well, WBAI is now back on the air, but these problems are just cascading, and it's not over with for sure. Even the people around KPFA didn't pay the property taxes on the Pacifica Network's property in Berkeley for 6 years, and the property was put up for auction, and we only discovered it right before it happened and prevented that. That's another long story. So the Pacifica Network's in very bad shape, very bad shape. And I believe this cabal that's behind a lot of this wants to take control, sell off the New York, the Houston, and the Washington, D.C. stations, and then take the money and pour them into the California stations, which would be KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. At least that's what people feel is the motivation. Also, there would be the management at the stations is corrupt, incompetent. So it's not a good picture. But anyway, I just wanted to let everybody know that we, whoever we are, won the vote. And so these people, this latest attempted takeover of the Pacifica Radio Network was not successful. So that's it in a nutshell. Thanks.
Thanks, Bonnie. At least it was good news. We don't always get that, so that was good. Okay, and then, let's see. I have an announcement to make that we reached out to John Whitehead, and I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's an author, and he's written a book in the last couple of years called Battlefield America, and it's about the militarization of our police forces and our last locks of our civil liberties. And he couldn't make our time frame, so we're going to be having a special interview or conversation with him next Wednesday. It's April 1st at 1 p.m. in the afternoon Eastern, And we're going to be recording it, but we would like as many people as can to join us with that. And if you can't join us, then you can listen to the recording. But we will be having that next Wednesday at 1 p.m. And he's going to be connecting his book and, you know, what's going on in America with the coronavirus. So it all sounds really interesting. So I hope you can join us. We will be sending out information on it. So if you didn't catch it all right now, that is happening. And then I also wanted to tell people about, you may have gotten the notice from AE, but tomorrow, actually, today they released the final report from the University of Alaska on World Trade Center 7. And they're wanting us all to help them send copies of the report to Congress. And tomorrow they're having a virtual presentation that they've invited people to. And you can find out about that by going to the AE website, so ae911truth.org/WTC7. So again, ae911truth.org/WTC7 if you wanted to participate. It's at 4 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. They're going to be doing that. So just that. Does anyone else have any announcements?
Yes, I do, Barb.
Barbara, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, there are exciting, wonderful, positive things happening with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Many of you may have recently received both our, as many of you know, I'm on the board, and many of you may have received the recent newsletter by email from both the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers, which basically just sent it out under their own aegis as well, the same newsletter. And the gist of that newsletter, and it's just one of two major developments that I'm going to tell you about in a nutshell here, but the first one from those newsletters from the Lawyers Committee and A&E is that, I believe it was just last Friday, but anyway, just a few days ago, I believe it was on the 20th, and what are we now? It's just the 25th or 26th, right? So a little under a week ago, the Lawyers Committee, in the person of our litigation director, Nick Harrison, and our New York City co-counsel, John O'Kelly. Now, many of you may not know that John O'Kelly has now been invited to and, thank goodness, has accepted to be another attorney on our board. So we have a brand new board member, John O'Kelly. So they were the co-counsel. And on the 20th or so of this month, March, the Lawyers Committee submitted an amended complaint, meaning a lawsuit, in court in New York State, in New York City. It's called a mandamus action. Now, we had already submitted a mandamus action previously. However, the government, the U.S. Attorney, came around and said, oh, no, you don't have any standing. If you can believe it, they said that Bob McElvain doesn't have standing, who lost his own son in the World Trade Center, and neither does the Lawyers Committee, and neither does Architects and Engineers. So we have now refiled either the law or the DOJ policy, Department of Justice policy, I'm not sure which or both probably, allow a filing of an amended complaint, an amended lawsuit on the same matter. And the policy or law requires the court to accept it on the first try. So they have accepted it, but they had no choice. And so we have just amended it and filed it a few days ago. And the exciting news is that we have added another count. Bottom line is you can go to the Lawyers Committee website and you can read it from the menu across the top, or if you got that newsletter, which I can send to Craig and Cheryl to post maybe a link to it along with the page for this show, the minutes for this program, for this call. But anyway, the bottom line of it is that we have refiled that suit, and we have added some very exciting new co-plaintiffs. So many of you know that some very courageous fire commissioners, Fire Commissioner Chris Goya, and four other fire commissioners from the Munson Fire District in New York, they signed a petition some months ago now supporting supporting our lawyers' committee petition demanding World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 grand jury, which we filed way back in April 10th of 2018. And the problem is that the U.S. Attorney's Office will not tell us whether they have in fact convened the grand jury and given our petition and evidentiary exhibits and supplements that we've filed with the U.S. Attorney since. They won't tell us what they've done with them. They won't tell us at all. They're claiming absolute grand jury secrecy. Well, we've done our research, our legal research, and we know that that's not true. So the only way they could try to stop us when we filed the first complaint, the first lawsuit, was to say, sorry, you don't have standing. Well, we beefed up our standing is the bottom line. And the exciting new plaintiffs, besides the lawyers' committee, besides architects and engineers, besides Bob McElvain, we now have more plaintiffs, co-plaintiffs, and they include the victims' family members who were in the audience when the fire commissioners voted to support the World Trade Center grand jury petition of the lawyers' committee. And those are the family members of two firefighters, martyred firefighters, Evans and Hetzel, and their I believe the spouse, or perhaps it's the brother, but in any case, an immediate family member of each are now co-plaintiffs. And also John O'Kelly, who is on our board and the co-counsel for the amended complaint, the amended lawsuit on our grand jury petition in New York City on the World Trade Center attack. His brother is now also a co-plaintiff. And I'm not exactly sure why he qualifies as a co-plaintiff, but there's a reason. There's a reason that he does. So we've beefed up our standing. We've added counts. And there's a link to it in the newsletter that we sent out announcing this, and also on the Lawyers Committee website. So that's the first really exciting development. There's a second exciting development, and that is that, believe it or not, to our knowledge, the Lawyers Committee has just recently won in court for the first time. We have recently won a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit at a magisterial level. It's been bumped to the court from that level back to the court. But it was found in our favor, and this is an FOI lawsuit that has to do with the World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7, or perhaps it's just 7, but it's the building performance report, and the government has been refusing to release it or the critical parts of it, so we had to do an FOIA. Of course, they refused it for one reason or another, one exception or another, so we appealed. We exhausted our internal remedies, and now we were then able to sue. We sued, and we just won at the first level. And the government was so shocked that it immediately pulled out the attorney on the government side and replaced it with a lackey. So we'll see where that goes. But the bottom line is we're going to go all the way to the Supreme Court with these if we have to. So it really is good news.
Wow, that's great, Barbara. Thank you for sharing all that. And thank you for all you guys are doing there at the Lawyers Committee. Fantastic. Are there any other announcements? Okay.
Well, I would like to say one other thing, and that is I would just like to say, Bonnie Faulkner, I miss you, soul sister. Let's talk. Okay.
Okay, Barb.
All right.
Okay. Great. And I guess we need to do one last thing, and that's approve the minutes from last month. So are there any objections to the minutes from last month, if anyone is still awake and can think about that? hearing none, then they're approved. Okay. And no need to approve the agenda. We've already done it, and so that's it. Okay.
We should do the roll. We should do the roll, Cheryl, even though we've lost a few people.
I wrote it all while we were talking, Craig. So, and a lot of people have left. So you go ahead if you want to. But I think it's
well. I only have the ones that are still on the call. But when we hang up, we'll get a report from the service with all the names. But I don't have. I can only sort of read off the 17 that are still here. If you've written them all down, maybe you want to read them.
I have 25 of them, and then we'll get the report.
Okay.
You,
so we're good?
You want, I was just thinking.
Just checking. Susan Serpa was here with me on my phone, so you want to include her in the role.
Oh, thank you for reminding
great.
Me of that. Yes,
great.
Well,
I'm just wondering, Cheryl, if you want to read, you might want to read your list just so we have it on the recording, just for the sake of keeping that routine
okay.
up.
Yep, I can do that. Okay, so we have Gregory Longo, who's here with me, so he doesn't show up on it. Susan Serpa, Fern Tishman, Frank Tolupko, James Hufford, Jessica Coco, Lawrence Fine, Lynn Bradbury, Malcolm, I only wrote down his first name, Malcolm, I can't remember your last name now. Are you there? Does anyone remember Malcolm's last name?
Yeah.
Malcolm Arnold.
Yeah.
Arnold.
Yeah. Okay. Marie Spike, Marty Hopper, Nita Renfrew, Pat O'Connell, Paul Zaremka, Peter Ketchum, Renee Parsons, Steve Stadola, Allison Maynard, Ann Hendricks, Tony Hall, Barbara Honegger, Barry Zwicker, Bonnie Faulkner, Kat McGuire, me and you, Craig, and Cynthia. McKinney.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah.
May I ask Renee's website? I missed it. Maybe others did as well.
I don't think she has a website. She just writes articles and gets them posted. She posts a lot on Global Research.
Okay.
So, but I can connect you with her via email if you want to ask, if you want to pursue that further. I don't think she has a website.
Well, all right. Thank you.
Okay, well, it's been a long night. Thank you, everyone, for joining us and for hanging in there till the end. I think it was a very informative call.
Hello?
You know, I learned a lot. I'm yeah.
Hello?
And I need to be thinking about how do we respond if they do try to force the vaccines on us and all of that. So maybe that's for another call. Well, definitely for another call, but all people will be thinking about that. Did someone else
hello?
Want to say something?
Yes. Yeah? Frank here?
Somebody's saying hello.
Yeah, hi, Frank.
Hello. Yeah, hi. I wanted to make a correction. I guess I was on mute or whatever. I wanted to make a correction to the minutes from last month.
Oh, okay. What would you like to
it's
change?
Quick. I'm sorry?
Okay.
Yeah, in the piece about the Mohammed and Malcolm X, it says in the minutes, Manhattan District Attorney has decided to reopen the murder investigation. No, he's deciding whether to reopen it.
Okay. Got it.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll fix
we'll,
that.
We'll make. Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Okay, great. That's good to know. Anything else?
Anything else?
All right. Hearing no other comments, stay safe, and we'll see you next month.
Night, Cheryl.
Okay, well,
night, everybody.
Bye.
Wash your hands. Wash your hands.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.